images appeal to our passions and not to our reasoning. Language makes propositional claims that can be refuted. Images leave impressions, but they don't leave propositional claims that can be argued down. So if you want to be manipulated, spend most of your time with visual-based, image-based news. If you want to stand up on your own two feet and be able to resist people's efforts to manipulate you, demand your news to be in language.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. I'm Shane Rosenthal, and joining me for this program is a guest we've had on the program many times before. T. David Gordon is professor of religion and Greek at Grove City College in Pennsylvania, where he also teaches a course in media ecology, which is the subject we'll be talking with him about on this particular broadcast. Dr. Gordon is the author of Why Johnny Can't Preach, Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns, and most recently, Promise, Law, Faith, Covenant Historical Reasoning in Galatians. T. David Gordon, it's great to have you back on the White Horse Inn.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So before we get started, I just have to say that, you know, I recently finished reading your book, Promise, Law, Faith, and was really impressed with your arguments, particularly as you addressed issues related to the new perspective on Paul and how we think about the difference between the old and new covenants. On this program, however, I'd like you to put on your media ecology hat as we survey many of the issues that have come up throughout this year. And then next week, we'll have you back on the program to discuss the thesis of your new book.
Fine with me. That's great, Shane.
So you've talked about this on the show before, but can you give our listeners a brief overview of the kinds of things you cover in the class you teach on media ecology?
Well, we do a very brief romp through the history of media. So oral cultures, you know, were the original forms of media. And then some cultures later became manuscript cultures where they etched into papyrus their important documents. After that, you have the development of the printing press. And then 400 years later, at the same time, mid-19th century, you have the first electronic technology, telegraph, and the first mass-produced image technology, photograph. And then by the 20th century, you have film, television. And then by the end of the 20th century, early 21st, you have the digital stuff. We didn't really realize at the time that the smartphone would be also its own epoch. But the fact that it made the digital world portable, most media ecologists now would say it's every bit as significant as the printing press or any of those other 5 or 6 major moments.
Right.
So we do a history of those to talk about them. It's pertinent in our day because media are multiplying commercially so rapidly, but it's actually an old humane question. How do the media we employ shape us as individuals and as cultures?
In an article you wrote for Modern Reformation a few years back on this topic of media ecology, you included a quote from Marshall McLuhan who said that, quote, "Today, in the electronic age of instant communication, I believe that our survival is predicated on understanding the nature of our new environment, because unlike previous environmental changes, the electric media constitute a total near instantaneous transformation of culture, values, and attitudes." We're really starting to see this transformation accelerate before our eyes, aren't we?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a nice quote from Marshall McLuhan at the time. And he was, of course, talking about the radio and television moment.
Yeah.
And now we're in a slightly different moment, aren't we, in which the rapidity of new media is escalating at a rate never before in human history.
And which is changing the world as we know it. I mean, you talk in your class about the isolation that's resulted from the use of smartphone technology and social media, particularly among today's youth.
Yeah, it's interesting that what they do is they are connected and yet disconnected at the same time. They're physically isolated, and yet they're constantly surveilling one another to see who's chatting with whom and who's sharing Instagrams with each other and so forth. So it's a curious form in which they're never as disconnected as I am out in the forest, totally disconnected, and yet they're never enjoying rich, humane companionship. And so they're connected at a distance.
In that same article you wrote, which I'll add to the show notes page for this episode, you said that not only are Google's algorithms tailored to each individual user, but various social software have created a universe for adolescents that is effectively adult-free.
Yes, it's a world without any adult supervision. It's really the flies. We're back to the island with young people, right? You know,
yeah.
That's what we've got.
This past September, Netflix released a fascinating documentary titled The Social Dilemma, which I would highly recommend that our listeners watch and discuss with their kids. And in that film, there's a discussion about the ways in which social media organizations end up manipulating our behavior so that we end up spending more and more of our time, you know, with our heads buried in our screens. And that more than anything, this is adversely affecting our youth.
Yeah.
Not long ago, I was at a church potluck in Italy where I noticed that while the adults were talking with each other, many of the teens were sitting along the back wall with their heads buried in their phones. It's not just a problem here in America, is it?
No, it is global. Remember, many of the producers of various software and hardware are multinational corporations.
Right.
You know, Apple is produced in China. Most of their products are produced in China, for instance. So the global market is what all of these people are interested in. And the attention of as many people as possible is what they're interested in. And so everything is designed to capture all subpopulations that they possibly can.
Another thing that that documentary discusses is the fact that teen and preteen suicide rates have steadily increased over the past decade as social media usage became normal.
Yeah, the interesting thing in most of those studies is there was very little change over the previous 40 or 50 years. And then around 2010 and following, you saw remarkable rates. Late teenage girls, the rates were 60 and 80% higher of attempted or real suicides. And for those in the younger years, like 12 to 15, it was even higher, you know, the 80 to 150% increases in either the attempt to harm themselves or actually the effective attempt to harm themselves. And so it was a very substantial increase in a very short amount of time. And it's basically the group, you may recall that in Gene Twenge's book, right, she talks about those born before 1988, those born right after 1995. And the latter are those who, by their early formative years, had a smartphone, and they are the ones most likely to harm themselves.
So what's the connection there? How do smartphones and social media increase those trends?
I think what happens is, while we would have thought the increasing of your social sphere was necessarily a good thing, like more drops of rain for a farmer, actually what it turns out in the developing young person's psyche, it's too many people to try to please. And so if you have a small circle of friends in your neighborhood, that's would have been my case, you know, the ones that you rode bikes with and played ball with,
right,
you kind of wanted to be on good terms with all of them. But after a while, you knew Chuck like this and Tim like this and Bob like that and so forth, and you have no problem basically satisfying them. If you have 100 Chucks and Bobs and Tims and so forth, that's really too much for a young person to try to keep up with. And if anyone viewing what you post something negative, you see, this is just crushing to you. Whereas your own friends, Bob and Chuck and Tim, that see you face to face, they kind of know you well enough that they don't want to hurt your feelings. But see, someone who knows you online doesn't feel that same sense of guardianship or protectorship, almost the way your friends you can squabble with. But then at school, if someone squabbles with you, your friend steps up for you, right?
Yeah.
But see, no one steps up for you on the internet. It's everyone's a potential critic, and there's really no one to defend you.
There was a really poignant scene in that documentary about a young preteen girl who is constantly taking pictures of herself and then adding them to her social media feed.
Yeah.
And while she seems to be obsessed with getting the feedback, she ends up getting really depressed by some of the negative comments about her appearance. And so it seems like, you know, as adults, we readily adopted this new technology without thinking about the unintended consequences of how these tools might end up adversely affecting our kids' own sense of their identity and worth.
Yeah, that's right. This Monday in our class, we devoted most of the evening to the discussion of unintended consequences. So I put up on my screen about 9 categories of media. And under each of those, I had about 10 or 12 things that in previous classes, I'd say, what are some unintended consequences of radio, of television, of photograph, and so forth. Huh. And then over the time, I've culled those answers together. And just now I present them as a handout to my students. And it's really rather remarkable how insightful the students are at recognizing that there are indeed unintended consequences to everything that's made. So when we make a shovel, the intended consequence is to put holes in the ground. The unintended consequences is calluses on your fingers, right? Now, that's not a moral statement. It's not a value statement. That is to say, if you play handball, you want to have a calloused hand because a hard hand hits the ball faster. Perhaps if you're a brain surgeon, you don't want a calloused hand. The simple fact of the matter is the consequence of using a shovel is calloused hands. And so we have to make some effort to understand both the intended consequences that led to the production of various media and the unintended consequences that have resulted from them. And we may reach a point in some cases where the unintended consequences are so negative that they outweigh the positive and intended consequences.
Right. Some critics are raising alarms about what they're calling a kind of surveillance capitalism, in which the government doesn't spy on us, but where instead we willingly give private corporations loads of data about ourselves based on the kinds of things we search for or stop to look at while scrolling in our social media feeds. Do you have any concerns about where this sort of thing might lead?
Well, a little bit. Yeah. Let's first of all back up 60 years and see the previous analogy. The previous analogy, mid-20th century, if we said who used visual media to manipulate, it was Stalin and Hitler and the like, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why Jacques Ellul, who's in the French underground when he was 16 years old during World War II, when he writes propaganda, it's the political manipulators he's writing about. Right. And of course, by the turn of the 20th century, it was the commercial manipulators writing commercial messages and so forth and manipulating us. Well, the same thing. At one point, it was the government that was, you know, the NSA and others, you know, recording all of our conversations. And now it's the commercial people who effectively are surveilling us. To me, the concern is not so much that they're making money or that they will disclose to other people that I'm buying a smaller shirt than someone who's of a normal size. The graver concern is the algorithm teaches them when I'm at one place on the internet, what I'll respond to when they give me two or three choices, so that they start sending me every time what I'm already subconsciously looking for, and therefore just keeping me on the internet longer than I want to be there.
Right.
That's the concern. Their goal is to get me on the internet many hours of the day. And that's what they're using the algorithms to do, is to increase that time.
Yeah. One person in the Social Dilemma documentary made the point that a company like Facebook ends up working to please its advertisers, and the user's attention ends up being the product that's being sold.
Yes.
And apparently what's now happening is that, you know, software is being developed and employed to find ways, as you're saying, to make this sort of thing more and more addictive to serve up more eyeballs to the advertisers.
That's exactly what they've designed it to do. So one of the things they've learned is because of our biological nature and our biological history, the species that survive in the woods as hunter-gatherers are those who have really remarkable alerting attention. That if they hear a twig snap, they can devote their attention to it really quickly because any animal large enough to snap a twig can hurt you. So we basically developed these remarkable alerting attentions at the expense of executive attention. And that's why when the medieval universities were founded, they created these safe spaces, actually, the ivy-covered walls, as it were intentional, to get inside where you don't have lions and tigers and bears, oh no, where you can actually think about the fundamental theorem of the calculus or some other serious problem. So we've now realized that the executive attention span is partly what makes a human different from the other creatures and enables us to solve so many of our problems. And what the internet is doing, it rewards our brain because we get a little dopamine every time we switch from one thing to another. Our brain does that. And so television had learned this earlier. In the 60s, the average television screenshot was 42 seconds. And then it got to 25 seconds and then 10 seconds. And in recent years, it's been like 2.5 seconds because the rapid shifting of either the camera angle or location or something keeps us enthralled. And so what that does then, all of our exposure to it, it continues to feed our alerting attention span at the expense of our executive attention span. And we have harder and harder times paying attention then.
Maggie Jackson talked about that in her book, Distracted, The Erosion of Attention and the Coming Dark Age. Do you think that she's onto something there, that the result of all this is cultural decline? In fact, maybe even a new dark age.
Yeah, it's very interesting. When she said the coming dark age, what she realized is that when they rediscovered ancient manuscripts, that's what moved us out of the medieval dark age into Renaissance and Reformation.
Yeah.
And what they discovered at Renaissance and Reformation was wisdom from cultures that were 1500 and 1600 and 1700 years antecedent to them that had been lost. And yes, I think the digital world, the electronic world, cuts us off from the printing press world, not by law, right, or anything else. Hmm. But when person after person says, I used to love the one rainy day on vacation because I'd curl up with a good book and a cup of coffee and read. And now they say, after 5 or 6 pages, I lose my train of thought and put the book down. I've lost my ability to take pleasure in reading.
Yeah.
So the rewiring of our brain is having a very significant consequence. And it will cut us off from the printed reality just as much as if the manuscripts had been lost.
And what we've been saying about social media is also true of television. You know, in order to get more eyeballs, content must be simplified and designed to entertain. And whenever I watch the History Channel, for example, you know, I tend to see programs like Ancient Aliens or Swamp Monsters rather than programs on Thucydides or Josephus.
Yeah. If even the History Channel can't connect us to history,
yeah,
then surely the rest of them can't.
Yeah.
Because here's a channel whose very name, it immediately attracts us because there might be something about Grant's presidency, right?
Right.
Or Lincoln, the Lincoln-Douglas debates, yeah, or whatever it might be, right? Or something as far back as the Peloponnesian Wars and things like this. But instead, we get ice road truckers, coming disasters, right? Sometimes they even have things about the future.
Right.
But there's almost no history on the History Channel. And so television as a medium cuts us off from the past.
Now, in your book, Why Johnny Can't Preach, you argued that the cultural effects of all this has impacted American Christianity, and particularly the quality of the sermons we're likely to hear. Why?
That's correct. My thesis was fairly simple. If, as a culture, we do not read as well as we once did, and if we do not compose as well as we once did, well, what does ministers do but read ancient texts and try to exposit them? And so inevitably then, the cultural shift, while I don't know that it influenced farming in a negative way or the selling of pharmaceuticals or the grocery business, I don't know if it, how it affected those professions, but it seems to have contributed in a very negative way to the ministry of expository preaching. By the way, speaking of which, you remember that when Neil Postman was talking about television, he looked back to the previous era, the Gutenberg era, and he called it the age of exposition. Isn't that interesting? But he referred to the printing press era as the age of exposition because once you had printed books, you could chat with someone about a Robert Frost poem. And here you had this fixed thing, a text, and then you could discuss or debate its meaning, right?
Yeah.
And so what happens is the visual world, you can't really do that. You can't really discuss after a half an hour of Seinfeld what was going on in the show.
Yeah, in fact, Postman says in that book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, that perplexity is a super highway to low ratings.
Yes.
You know, he says this means there must be nothing that has to be remembered, studied, applied, or worst of all, endured. And so in this world, everything has to be immediately accessible since contentment, not the growth of the learner, is paramount. So how should churches attempt to deal with this reality? Because if they focus too much on studying the often perplexing sayings of Jesus, for example, rather than telling people what they want to hear, aren't they just going to lose out to those other churches in the community that keep things simple and tickle people's ears?
Yeah, I think so. I think that what you just decide to do is you look at the body of Christ and you say, some of the churches in the body of Christ today are feeder churches. They can give a very basic exposure to a superficial understanding of the Christian faith and religion. Insincere people can really find saving knowledge of Christ in them, but they can't go very far.
Yeah.
You may recall that very courageous report from Willow Creek admitting that when they surveyed their members, the ones who had been at the church the longest were the least spiritually satisfied.
Right.
I thought it was very courageous for them to share that with other people because it was almost a no vote on their whole program, and yet they candidly shared that with the evangelical community. And so I think what happens is if you sort of short-circuit the demands of the Christian religion and the knowledge of its important truths for the sake of an audience in this day, then you really have nothing to offer them if they come. So I think some churches will just have to say, in the providence of God, some people who get stunted after a point of time in other churches and are looking for something more, we will be that something more that they will come to. And they do come. They do eventually tire of the children's diet at some point. You want an adult diet.
Yeah, I think that comes up in the book of Hebrews when it talks about the importance of getting beyond the milk to solid food.
That's right. And you may recall how David Wells pithily put it when he said that some people are so desirous of reaching the unchurched that they have unchurched the reached.
Right.
And so what happens is, yes, if you continue to dumb down, as it were, at some point the people who are already there say, well, I may as well just stay at home. There's nothing here for me.
What's your view of the state of news media and journalism in this present moment?
Well, even 10 years ago, I was suggesting to my students that journalism may be becoming a dying career path.
Huh.
Because what we've gone to over the last three or four centuries is a very fundamental change. At the time of the Federalist Papers, a newspaper would have very few stories in it and each story would be very comprehensively covered. If your newspaper was only published every 2 weeks, then scooping someone on what happened yesterday was irrelevant. And instead, you dealt with things that were abidingly significant, so every 2 weeks you could discuss another Federalist paper. And so what happened is the ratio of the number of events to the amount of commentary was very low on the number of events and very high on the intelligent, thoughtful commentary about the event. And then over time, the sales of newspapers and other outlets moved to let's give them more events and less intelligent commentary, to the point now with the internet and everyone with a phone in their pocket, now actually what happens is everyone who's alive with a smartphone can post a 6-second clip and actually lead to the destruction of many American cities. And I fear now that people who get their news from people tweeting and this kind of a thing, they will just bypass the middleman altogether and they won't really have any responsible news.
Interesting.
One advantage of the time of my childhood, when we complained that there were only three networks and those three networks moderated what news we knew and what news we didn't know, was at least we had a moderator. It wasn't until we lost all moderation that we realized, oh no, opening the floodgates creates its own kind of a problem.
Yeah.
No one's moderating. And so it's just a free for all.
One stat that I saw recently indicated that something like over 60% of today's young people end up getting their news from social media. And so if our understanding of what's happening in the world is primarily based on an image that we see scrolling through our feed, you know, I think that's something actually that Neil Postman talks about in his book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, the way in which out of context images end up distorting the way we think about things.
Yes. Remember, he called it the peekaboo world.
Yeah, that's right.
Like playing with a child and you take the blanket away and you do peekaboo. He called the television world the peekaboo world. And even the television world was not as bad as the smartphone world, where everyone can do this clip. So if you think about how the George Floyd situation would have been reported if all we had was news reporting with a newspaper, no visual images, you'd have to do the who, what, when, where, why of standard journalism.
Right.
You would look at that whole act very differently than the 6-second clip. It looks like they threw the man to the ground with the intention to harm. And so we realize that we don't know events in the current world the way we once did. If we lived in a village in the 18th century and someone said, I hear Farmer Brown's barn burned down. You say, yes, I walked past it yesterday. It burned right to the ground. Well, you lived in a village and you knew what happened in the village because you could see it with your own eyes. Now we have mediated news. And in 1922, you remember Walter Lippmann wrote the book Public Opinion after he had served as a propagandist for the Allied forces in World War I. And his fundamental thesis is we don't live with the real events, but pseudo events. We deal with the reported events. And so he was recognizing that it's the report that influences our behavior, not the event itself, and that we need to be aware of this, that what we have seen is the report and not the event.
Yeah.
People who are not aware of that will view the report as though it's the event.
Where perception becomes reality.
Yes. And in the case of the Floyd thing, already we have three reports, at least I would say three pertinent reports. We have the 6-second video that everyone saw, and then it was a little time before we had the coroner's report. That's the second report. The coroner's report indicated that he had an 11 level of fentanyl in his system and that he had certified deaths to fentanyl before on as little as a 3. And so it's almost 4 times a lethal dosage of fentanyl in his system. And he expressly said in the coroner's report he did not die of asphyxiation or strangulation. Then the third report of that event, so pertinent, is the 20-minute or so body cam from the police officers.
Right.
Where it shows other black people in the car that the police were perfectly courteous with, and they were actually very courteous with Mr. Floyd for the longest amount of time. And he was the one that was resisting and resisting and resisting, and he was saying he couldn't breathe before he got out of his car. Well, if you see him saying 18 minutes before he dies, I can't breathe, because fentanyl, you know, cuts down your respiration and can even stop it, and Mr. Chauvin didn't get there until 12 minutes later, it's a totally different report.
Yeah, all of that is relevant to the case, but rather than thinking through all the details or considering all that factored into the overall context, we all sort of had this visceral reaction to the disturbing footage we saw in that video clip.
That's right. So what happens is images appeal to our passions and not to our reasoning. And that's why Jacques Ellul said all of your mid-20th century propagandists, especially Hitler, used image rather than language, because language makes propositional claims that can be refuted. Images leave impressions, but they don't leave propositional claims that can be argued down. So here's the fascinating one from Hitler. Hitler had already written Mein Kampf. He could have given it away to the Germans, couldn't he? He had the copyright to it. He was its author. And further, with his ego, he might have wanted everyone to read his book. But instead, he hired Leni Riefenstahl to produce the film Triumph of the Will. He took the best film producer of his generation, and she became his propagandist, because you can't refute image, right? So the manipulator Hitler did not use his own book written in language. He used Leni Riefenstahl's film to do his propaganda with. So media ecologists say, if you want to be manipulated, spend most of your time with visual-based, image-based news. If you want to stand up on your own two feet and be able to resist people's efforts to manipulate you, demand your news to be in language. Because in linguistic form, people have to have the courage to stand up and make a statement and say, Officer Chauvin killed this man. Now, that's a statement, right? And you could say, okay, what would it take to prove or disprove that? And then you can go about to disprove it. If you just put an image out there, people normally passionately leap into the fray and to a conclusion from which they then can't back down. We built a judicial system to basically protect people through due process. Now we're looting and burning and rioting, rushing to judgment before any proper trial.
Right.
No confronting of one's accusers, no gathering of evidence. The one thing we don't want is elected officials who govern by who burns down the most buildings.
Yeah.
That's not the process we want. We want our elected officials to institute processes after due diligence and proper study of the matter. And we do not want them to say the loudest group who burns down the most buildings is going to get our attention.
You know, as we were talking about media and issues that come up in the news, what I've personally found is that the only way to really get to the bottom of a story is to do my own digging and investigative work. So, you know, whether the issue has to do with the coronavirus, the wearing of masks, social distancing, or the latest riot, I've just been increasingly aware of the fact that a lot of the voices that are out there are actually distorting my understanding of important issues, almost in the same way that the History Channel distorts my understanding of actual history.
Yeah, I think that that's right. The very fortunate exception, I think, is once or twice in our lifetime, we run across an author or journalist whose works we have been exposed to in sufficient amount to come to regard them as unusually credible.
Yeah.
I think especially with authors, you know, those who write books and so forth, we run across some whom we regard to have done the painstaking work that you're talking about, and they establish that as their pattern. And sometimes you'll find an investigative journalist who writes for one of the major things and probably gets paid well for it because they establish a reputation that they actually are thorough. And so you sometimes find such people, but apart from that, you say, I'm going to have to look at this myself.
So the idea of challenging popular narratives by doing your, you know, one's own careful research, study, and investigation is not something we should only apply to the news stories of our day. But if you think about it, it's something that can actually lead to reformation and renewal in our churches. You know, in other words, we shouldn't just blindly accept all spiritual views, even when they sound appealing, but we should test all things to see whether the things we're hearing actually measure up with the scriptures.
Yeah, that's right. And each generation has to sort of own the confession of faith for itself.
Right.
Even our confessional standards that are several hundred years old and themselves standing on the shoulders of ones that antedated it by 150 years, each generation has to work through it again and find the genius of it and why these are important truths. We can't just say, well, our grandfathers like this, so we like it. We have to own it again for ourselves. And so how much more, which confessional tradition we're going to adopt and which understanding of the faith we're going to embrace. At some point, we have to accept the adult responsibility of owning our opinions.
Yeah, this is what Paul ends up saying in Acts chapter 17. You know, he commends the Bereans for not just believing anything he, even as an apostle, said, but they looked to see whether the things he taught were actually there in the scriptures.
Yeah, they examined the scriptures to see if these things were so.
Yeah.
And he called them more noble than the others for doing that, right? Had a nice term of approval for them for doing this.
Yeah.
So I think it's right. Conscientious faith only exists where you've exercised a reasonable amount of thought. Mm-hmm. You've been persuaded that a thing is right, and now you feel like it's your conscientious duty to follow the position that has the most reasoning and evidence for it, including religious truths, especially religious truths.
That's why John says, test all things, but hold on to the good.
Yeah, that's right. And so that's part of being an adult, is no longer believing something because mom and dad told me.
Right.
But believing it for additional reasons that you've considered it primarily with Scripture as your fundamental test of truth, and come to believe this is the testimony of Holy Scripture.
Which is one of the reasons I love that Reformation slogan, reformed and always reforming according to the Word of God.
Yeah, that's right. I think that ideally, like an escalator, we might even progress through time, because standing on the shoulders of previous generations,
right,
accepting the baton as they hand it to us, we embrace it and hold on to it firmly and find that it's a good one. And then as we race forward to hand it to another generation, maybe we add a little bit, another inch to the length of the baton ourselves. Maybe we discover further riches of truth in Holy Scripture. That would be the ideal way that cultural progress would be made.
Well, this is the reason I'd like to have you on again next week to discuss your book, Promise, Law, and Faith, because I think you've done some really important investigative work that helps us to see some of the ways in which the message of Paul has often been distorted. Give us a teaser. What's your thesis in Promise, Law, Faith?
Well, negatively, my thesis is that both the dominant Protestant tradition, Luther and Calvin, and the new perspectives on Paul have misunderstood the problem at Galatia.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, insofar as their misunderstanding of the problem at Galatia is pertinent to their interpretation, insofar as that's the case, they slightly miss what the book is actually about. Positively, my thesis is that for Paul, the Greek word nomos, normally translated law, is not a reference to God's moral will, and it's not a reference to a legalistic abuse of God's moral will. It's a reference to the covenant made between Yahweh and the Israelites at Sinai, a covenant characterized by law-giving. So I titled the book Promise, Law, Faith, because Paul uses the word promise several times there as a figure of speech to refer to the Abrahamic covenant in its entirety. He calls the Sinai covenant law because it is so characterized by these great numbers of imperatives that Moses delivers at Sinai and afterwards. He calls the New Testament, when he says, before faith came, we were under the law, he means that before the new covenant, before Christ, in whom we put our faith, came, we were under the Sinai covenant. So I take a covenant historical reading of the book, and to my knowledge, no one has really read the book that way before.
So it sounds like it wouldn't make a good TV show.
My students right now who are translating Greek, they'd probably tell you it also makes a terrible Greek class.
Well, folks, you've been hearing from T. David Gordon, author of Why Johnny Can't Preach, Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns, and more recently, Promise, Law, Faith, which we'll be talking with him about next week. Dr. Gordon, thanks so much for taking the time to be with me on this episode of The White Horse Inn.
Thanks very much, Shane. Great to be with you again.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org. You can also give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. 7556. We'll see you next time at the White Horse Inn.